Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling something, well, something that might sound like it belongs in courtrooms or classrooms, but it turns out it's fundamental to how we all work together, especially when things, you know, go sideways. We're doing a deep dive into restorative practices.
Yeah, and we're using a key document from the International Institute for Restorative Practices, the IIRP, as our guide. They've really honed a specific way of talking about this, a framework.
Right. So our mission today is to unpack these core ideas from the IIRP. What are restorative practices really? According to them, anyway. And the really interesting part for us, how can these principles offer like genuine insights for things like software development, project work, and maybe crucially, handling incidents?
Exactly. We'll look at their concepts and, you know, see how they might explain why some teams just handle pressure so much better than others.
Okay, let's jump right in then. The source material, it kicks off by saying they're defining terms very precisely for their own community. They stress that their definition of, say, a restorative conference isn't just any old meeting. Why is that precision so important here?
Well, it's about keeping the meaning clear, avoiding dilution. Terms get popular, people start using them loosely. So if someone says restorative practices, the IIRP wants their community, at least, to understand the specific thinking and methods behind it.
Makes sense.
They mention things like community justice, like teen courts. These involve the community, sure, but they might not include that direct meeting between the person who caused harm and the person affected.
Okay. And that direct meeting, that's central to how the IIRP defines actual restorative justice, isn't it?
Precisely. For them, restorative justice specifically involves bringing together victims, offenders, and their supporters to really grapple with the harm. Those other community models might be valuable, but they often lack that direct dialogue piece. So RJ is just one part of the bigger picture for them.
Got it. Setting boundaries. So zooming out, how do they define restorative practices overall? Sounded a bit academic in the source. Social science? Social capital?
Yeah, the formal definition is a social science focused on building social capital and achieving social discipline through participatory learning and decision making. But think of it more simply as the study of how people can connect and work together better, especially when there's conflict or harm.
Okay, social capital, social discipline, participation. Let's make that concrete. What are the actual goals? What benefits does the source say you get from this?
Well, there's reducing crime and conflict, improving behavior, strengthening communities. But the ones that really leap out for, say, workplaces and teams are restoring relationships and repairing harm.
Restoring relationships and repairing harm. Yeah, that feels incredibly relevant.
Yeah.
Whether it's a small team disagreement or a massive system failure.
Absolutely. And here's a really critical distinction the IIRP makes. Restorative justice, that reactive part after the harm, is just a subset of restorative practices. RP is much broader.
Broader how?
It includes the response, yes. But crucially, it also includes the proactive stuff. Building relationships, strengthening the community before anything goes wrong.
Ah, like building up resilience beforehand. The source had that public health analogy, right?
Yeah, it's a great one. RJ is like tertiary prevention, treating the illness after it happens. Restorative practices covers that, but also primary prevention, building health and strength before you get sick. Creating an environment where problems are less likely and handled better when they do occur.
That proactive bit feels huge for teams, which brings us back to social capital. The source defines it, mentions Putnam. What is social capital in this context?
They talk about it as the connections between people. It's the trust, the mutual understanding, the shared values, the ways of behaving that, you know, bind us together and make cooperation possible. The source really emphasizes that strong social capital makes everything else easier responding to issues, creating a good atmosphere day to day.
So on a team, social capital isn't just being nice. It's the actual network of trust and understanding that lets you work effectively, especially when things get tough.
Exactly. Think about a big incident, right? If you've got high social capital, trust, respect, clear communication lines, a shared goal, the team can mobilize fast, share information openly, even though I don't know stuff, and fix it without getting bogged down in blame or defensiveness.
Whereas if it's low,
that's when you see hesitation, finger pointing, people covering their backs. It slows everything down.
Okay. Yeah, that makes total sense. It's like the hidden plumbing of teamwork.
Yeah.
So if building that capital is the foundation, how do authority and interaction styles fit in? The source talks about a social discipline window.
This is a really neat model. It maps different approaches based on two axes.
Yeah.
Control, like setting limits, standards, and support, encouragement, nurturing. It gives you four basic styles.
Okay, so you've got doing to people, that's high control, low support.
Yeah.
Punitive, just rules.
Right. Then there's doing for them, high support, but low control. Permissive, maybe paternalistic, solving their problems instead of enabling them.
Then not doing, low on both.
Yeah.
Neglectful, just leaving people adrift.
Exactly. Sink or swim. And then the fourth box, the sweet spot for restorative practices, doing with. This is high control and high support. It's about maintaining standards and accountability, but doing it through collaboration and relationship.
And this doing with, that seems to be the central hypothesis the source puts forward, isn't it? That people are basically happier, more cooperative, more productive, and more likely to change positively when authority figures work with them, not to them or for them.
Yes, that's the core belief. And they explicitly say this applies to organizational leadership, to managers. It's a direct contrast to punitive approaches, which, as researchers like Braithwaite pointed out, often rely on shame and stigma, which can actually hinder positive change.
Right. Instead of pushing someone out,
yeah,
you're keeping them connected and accountable inside the group. Okay, so doing with is key. The source also mentioned a restorative practices continuum. It's not just about big formal meetings.
Definitely not. That's crucial. The continuum shows it's a spectrum. At one end, you have really informal, everyday things like affective statements or questions, simple interactions. At the other end, you have the more formal, structured stuff like circles or conferences.
So the day-to-day work, the proactive building of social capital, and that doing with culture,
yeah,
that happens mostly on the informal end of the spectrum.
Exactly. The source stresses that using these informal practices consistently builds what they call a restorative milieu, just an everyday environment that fosters awareness, empathy, responsibility. Formal processes are powerful when needed, but it's the cumulative effect of the small, everyday interactions that really builds the foundation and makes the formal stuff work better.
Like daily exercise for team health rather than just emergency surgery. And part of that daily health, according to the source, involves dealing with affect with emotions.
Yes, they reference Tompkins and Nathanson here. Healthy relationships need space for expressing a range of emotions freely. And they specifically dig into the role of shame.
Shame. Okay, that feels really relevant to high-stakes work or dealing with mistakes. The source mentions Nathanson's compass of shame.
Right. Shame is described as a powerful driver of behavior, often triggered when something interrupts positive feelings, connection, excitement. It's deeply uncomfortable. Nathanson's compass outlines four typical reactions: withdrawal, hiding, isolating oneself, attack, self-criticism, depression, avoidance, denial, distraction, maybe substance use, and attack, other blaming, anger, lashing out.
Wow. So shame can really push people into counterproductive, even destructive patterns. How does the restorative approach help manage that?
It aims to create a safe space where people can express shame and other difficult emotions like fear or anger without being judged or punished. By allowing it to be voiced, often in a structured way, its intensity can lessen. It lets people move past those reactive stances, withdrawing or attacking, and actually engage constructively again.
So in a tech context, after an incident, maybe?
Yeah, exactly. Engineers might feel ashamed if they made an error, scared about the fallout, frustrated. A restorative approach, maybe in a postmortem, creates a way to acknowledge that safely so the focus can shift to learning and fixing, not just reacting to the shame.
That makes a lot of sense, letting the air out of the shame balloons, so to speak. This connects to another concept the source highlights for organizational effectiveness, fair process. They mentioned Kim and Malmorn's work.
Fair process is really doing with applied to decision making. It's not about whether everyone loves the final outcome, but whether the process for getting there felt fair. There are three core principles they identify:
engagement, explanation, and expectation clarity.
That's it. Engagement. You genuinely involve people in the decisions that affect them. You listen to their input before the decision is locked in. Explanation. You clearly explain the reasoning behind the final decision, why it was made, even if it wasn't everyone's first choice. And expectation clarity. You make sure everyone understands the decision and what's expected of them going forward. Roles, responsibilities, next steps.
Those three things seem incredibly practical. For any team lead, any manager, really, it's about being transparent, making sure people feel heard, and ensuring everyone knows where things stand, not just having decisions handed down.
Precisely. It builds trust, fosters buy-in, reinforces that social capital we talked about earlier.
Okay, so we've got the core ideas. the specific IIRP definitions, mm-hmm. proactive versus reactive, social capitals as the bedrock, the doing with idea and the social discipline window, the informal to formal continuum, handling affect and shame safely, and using fair process. The source also briefly describes some of the more formal processes, restorative conferences, circles.
Right. Those are the more structured ways to apply these principles, typically used after something significant has happened. A formal conference, for instance, is a facilitated meeting bringing together those harmed, those who caused harm, and their supporters to really talk through what happened, the impact, and how to make things right. Circles are maybe more versatile, used for building community, solving problems, often uses a talking piece to ensure everyone gets heard equally, feels safe.
And the source does say these formal things, like conferences, can be used in workplaces too for conflict or wrongdoing.
Yes, they explicitly mention that. But again, much of their power comes from having that foundation of informal practices already in place.
Right, like those everyday effective statements and effective questions. Can you give us a bit more on those informal tools? They sound really useful.
Yeah, they're simple but powerful. An effective statement is just using an I statement to express how someone else's behavior impacted your feelings. So instead of stop interrupting, which is doing to, it's when you interrupt while I'm speaking, I feel frustrated because I lose my train of thought. The source uses a teacher example like, when you disrupt, I feel sad. It focuses on the impact, not just breaking a rule.
Okay, so translating that, maybe in a code review. When I see uncommented, complex logic, I feel a bit confused because it takes me longer to understand the intent instead of just add comments here.
Perfect. It's less accusatory, more about sharing the impact. Then effective questions prompt reflection in the other person. Instead of, why did you break the build? You might ask things like, who do you think might be affected now that the build is broken? Or what do you think needs to happen to get things back on track? Or how could we prevent this next time?
So you're guiding them to think about the consequences and solutions themselves, rather than just telling them off and giving them the answer.
Exactly. It encourages empathy and responsibility over just compliance or defensiveness. And using these consistently day by day, that's what builds that restorative milieu, that culture where people are naturally more aware of their impact, more empathetic, and more likely to take ownership.
Okay. This is where it all starts to really, you know, lick into place for areas like ours.
Mm-hmm.
How do these concepts, building trust proactively, working with people, handling shame constructively, fair process, communicating impact, how does this translate to the often high-pressure world of software development, operations, and especially incident management?
Right. Let's bridge that gap directly, because this IIRP framework, it offers some incredibly potent tools for the tech world. Perhaps the biggest insight for me is that incident management isn't solely a technical challenge. It's fundamentally a relationship and communication challenge layered right on top of the technical one. Restorative practices gives us a language and a toolkit for that human layer.
Say more about that. How does that play out?
Okay, take social capital during a production outage. How quickly and effectively you respond depends massively on the pre-existing trust and communication pathways between the actual people involved. Engineers across different teams, SREs, support folks, product managers, maybe even leadership. If that social capital is high, if people trust each other, have established ways to communicate respectfully, feel a shared sense of purpose, then coordination is way smoother. Information flows, even uncertain information. People collaborate faster.
And if the trust isn't there?
If social capital is low, every interaction becomes friction. People hold back information, they worry about blame, they get defensive. It grinds the response to a halt. So proactively building that social capital through things like cross-team projects, blameless postmortems done well, social events, pair programming, that's primary prevention for better incident response.
So the relationships you build before the pager goes off are as critical as the monitoring tools during it.
Absolutely critical. Then think about the doing with principle. How does leadership behave during an incident? Is it one person barking orders, doing to? Is it one senior hero diving in alone while everyone else watches, doing for? Or is the incident lead working with the team facilitating the diagnosis, supporting collective decision making, empowering everyone involved to contribute their piece of the puzzle? And afterwards, in the postmortem, is it leadership working with the team to understand? Or to the team by assigning fault.
Yeah, I can see that distinction clearly. And the restorative continuum fits right in too. Those daily informal practices like a quick effective statement in chat. Hey, when that service went down briefly, I felt pretty anxious until we figured out it was just a config push. Or asking an effective question after a near miss. What helped us catch that before it impacted users? How can we make that more reliable?
Yeah.
Those build the psychological safety needed for the bigger stuff.
Precisely. That everyday practice makes the formal post-incident review, which you can think of as a kind of structured conference or circle, feel like a safe, productive learning opportunity, not something to dread.
And inside that postmortem, dealing with affect and shame becomes vital. Incidents are inherently stressful. People feel fear, frustration, maybe embarrassment or shame if they feel their actions contributed. If that review process feels punitive or even just judgmental, those shame reactions, withdrawal, blaming others, minimizing, they kick in automatically and shut down learning.
Right. A restorative postmortem explicitly creates, or should create, a safe container. It uses facilitation to allow those emotions to be acknowledged non-judgmentally. Wow, that was a tense couple of hours for everyone, or I felt really under pressure when X happened. Processing that safely allows the team to move beyond defensiveness and actually focus on systemic issues and collective learning. It's about repairing the harm the incident caused to the team itself, the stress, the frayed nerves, the potential damage to trust.
And fair process in those reviews maps perfectly. Engagement. Make sure everyone genuinely involved or significantly impacted gets included. Engineers, ops, support, maybe even product or customer success. Create space for all perspectives on the timeline, the contributing factors, the impact, explanation. Be transparent about the technical findings, the sequence of events, why certain actions were taken during the response, and the rationale for proposed fixes. Transparency is key to rebuilding trust.
And expectation clarity. Define clear, concrete action items. Who owns them? When are they due? Make sure everyone understands the plan to prevent recurrence and improve the system going forward.
It really shifts the focus, doesn't it? From who gets blamed to how do we learn and improve together. It makes the postmortem a genuinely collaborative sense-making and planning session.
It turns it from a potential trial into a collective process of understanding and strengthening the system and the team.
So, looking through this restorative lens, incident management isn't just about fixing the technical glitch and writing a report. It's fundamentally also about repairing harm. Yes, harm to users or data, but also harm to team morale, to trust between teams, to psychological safety.
And restoring relationships, rebuilding confidence within the team, reinforcing connections with dependent teams, and restoring trust with your users or customers through clear communication and demonstrated improvement.
Which is miles away from a purely technical review that ignores the people involved, or even worse, a punitive process that actively damages trust and makes future incidents harder to handle well. This framework gives specific ways to address that crucial human dimension.
It offers a practical path towards building teams that aren't just technically proficient, but are also relationally robust teams that can navigate the inevitable failures and conflicts of complex work in a way that actually makes them stronger.
Wow. Yeah, it really reframes things. It's not just about fixing bugs faster. It's about building fundamentally healthier, more resilient teams that can learn effectively from mistakes. Okay, so wrapping up this deep dive, it seems restorative practices using the IRP's thoughtful framework offers really powerful practical tools way beyond where we might expect to find them. By focusing on building on social capital before crises, adopting that doing with stance in how we lead and collaborate, making space for emotions like shame to be handled constructively, and embedding fair process, we can build teams that are not just more effective, but more humane and much better at turning difficult experiences like incidents into real opportunities for learning and repair.
The core ideas sound simple, but putting them into practice consistently, even in small ways, can genuinely shift how a team functions.
Absolutely. So here's a thought to leave you with. What's one small, informal, restorative practice you could try incorporating into your daily interactions this week? Maybe using an effective statement to share the impact of someone's action on you. Perhaps asking an effective question after a minor issue to prompt reflection instead of blame. Just consider how consciously building that social capital, strengthening those connections and that trust before this next inevitable pressure cooker situation might change everything about how you and your team get through it and what you learn from it afterwards.